And good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. You know, the world is accelerating at such an incredible pace. When I last spoke to you, which was literally just a few hours ago, we were anticipating results in Nevada for the caucuses for the Democratic Party, and in South Carolina, should not do that, I have relatives there. In South Carolina, we were expecting results on the Republican side, and of course we got both. And both have now recontested this race, this whatever we're engaged in. So I thought it was kind of time to maybe take a look back in time again. So I've called one of our favorite people, Richard Spence, historian at the University of Idaho. And we're going to spend some time this morning kind of looking at the election. Not a lot, but just a little. Then we're going to flash back into secret societies and the most extraordinary individual in terms of secret societies, probably in the 20th century, which is a guy named Aleister Crowley. So let me continue introducing Richard. Dr. Spence is a professor of history, as I said, at the University of Idaho. His special interests include modern Russian, military espionage, and occult history, and the history of anti-Semitism. One of his most popular courses deals with the role of conspiracies and secret societies in history. And I'm going to kind of, come at this current election from that point of view for a little while, because is it possible that we're seeing kind of played out on the reality television stage, in fact, a very interesting conspiracy? I'll ask Richard, in a few minutes, some of those questions. Anyway, without further ado, welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight, our old friend, Dr. Richard Spence. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Richard.
It's going to get double here, yes.
Yes, it is.
Okay, let me start with a kind of a big picture question. And that is, if we go up to 30,000 feet, which is the favorite phrase these days, what do you think in terms of the outsider label applied to both Sanders and Trump as a sign of a fundamental revolution against and within the political establishment?
Well, it's an interesting question. Are Trump and again, Bernie Sanders representatives of this kind of popular revolt against a kind of oligarchy? And, one of the things that we just saw collapse was the campaign of Jeb Bush. And now there are people saying that the Bush dynasty is finished. I don't know. There's still lots of Bushes out there, so I wouldn't write them out of history just yet. That may or may not be the end of Jeb's presidential ambitions, but he's not that old, and it's another 4 or 8 years down the road.
Well, it used to be axiomatic that if you had all the money, you basically won.
Right.
And Bush put in, I think he raised through his super PAC in an incredible short period of time, something like $100 million. And he pitched it at everybody in the Iowa and the New Hampshire campaigns and in South Carolina, and he kept coming in fourth or fifth or sixth or fourth. It really, something interesting is going on, Richard. What is it? Because money no longer equals speech.
Never, his campaign never caught fire. I mean, the simple explanation, the one that I would give, and maybe it's too simple, is that his big problem was that his last name was Bush. And rightly or wrongly, I'm going to get into Bush bashing here, but the previous Bush administration has left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. It isn't a period that's associated with, it's associated with 9/11. It's associated with the kind of chaos in the world and changes in the country that have come since then. And I think if there's one thing that I don't put a huge amount of faith in polls, but I think one thing they tend to suggest is that a lot of Americans are dissatisfied, maybe for different reasons, about the direction the country is going, and that was his problem. His last name was Bush. Maybe if he'd been selling the same product and he didn't have Bush on the label, it might have been more successful, or maybe it's him. But the thing is, we've now got this idea that the campaign certainly hasn't gone the way that I think the media, and I'm talking about what we tend to think of as the regular establishment media, thinks it should have gone or expected it to go. And you know, the simple, if you go back a couple of years, the simple explanation was that Hillary Clinton wasn't so much going to have to win the nomination, she was going to be coronated.
Mm.
It was almost taken for granted that she was going to be the only real candidate that was going to emerge, and that didn't happen. And whether or not Bernie Sanders is able to unseat her, whether or not his sort of rebellious campaign succeeds, the mere fact that it's there, I think, was something that took a lot of people by surprise.
And the fact that it's gone from a few percent to 50-50.
He's giving her a run for the money.
And he's telling everybody he's a damn socialist.
Yes.
Did you see that poll? Did you see that poll today where most Democrats identified themselves more with socialistic aspects of government and Republicans more with capitalistic, and the ratios between generations proclaiming these views is very striking and very dramatic. In other words, we seem to have lost connection to the actual definition of these terms, and we're now in this television age where being a socialist means you're not, you know, for basically letting poor people die on the street.
Well, I mean, in a way, it may also just be a kind of reality check, and it's, I mean, let's face it, whatever side of the political equation one is on, the Democratic Party, at least for the last few decades, has clearly represented what could be called the American left. It's a left-of-center party, and it also embraces a wide spectrum of people, and the Republican Party is pretty much the right wing of the political spectrum. And there probably have been, I mean, there's a question as to whether or not people even understand what the term socialist means. I think there are some people who do it. And I think there's been that there's a strong element in the American Democratic Party, which has pretty much always been the equivalent of socialist parties in Europe or the Labour Party in Britain. I mean, that's the other thing. The Labour Party in Britain, by the way, for anybody who doesn't know it, is the British Socialist Party. But it calls itself the Labour Party, and this really goes back to an origin, to kind of avoid that connotation. But everybody's known that the Labour Party is the Socialist Party. And I don't think, and keep in mind, just in case anybody's objecting, I'm not saying that the American Democratic Party is a socialist party, but that those people who, whether they know it or not, would more or less subscribe to a socialist program, you would find them in the Democratic Party, not in the Republican Party. And maybe we're just becoming more realistic with what those terms might be. You know, Sanders has been a kind of minor fixture of the American political scene for a very long time. You know,
very long
there
time.
He's been a kind of lone socialist in Congress, and, you know, not quite a joke, but let's put it this way, he didn't have any party behind him, but now he's certainly, you know, you can't call him a joke anymore. He has certainly brought into question whether or not Hillary Clinton is the inevitable and overwhelmingly popular nominee of the Democratic Party. There seems to be a lot of, you know, it's similar in this way. If Bush didn't sell, I'm not sure Clinton sells very well. And that may be her biggest baggage, is that she's dragging along that name and everything that people tend to associate with the previous Clinton regime. You know, it had its fair share of scandal, shall we say, and while she may try to present herself as a kind of victim of that scandal, or someone who was on the wrong end of it, she's still got the name, she's still got the baggage that goes with it. And I think that's what a lot of Americans maybe think that, you know, believe, or at least hope that they're throwing off, if it's true, is that they're trying to throw off this baggage that goes with these names. You know, Bush and Clinton are names that go back to the 90s, which, of course, isn't that long ago, mm-hmm. but to some people it is. And they wake up all of those emotions and all of those ideas of a recent past history, which is divisive and troublesome. And I think partly that's what both of them are suffering from, what both Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush suffered from was their names. But also, I think in some ways, people are just kind of tired of the same old, same old.
Well, you know the old cliche joke. You know, you keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. You're nuts. We've been doing the same thing on both sides of the aisle for decades now. And instead of getting better, things have been getting worse and worse and worse. The middle class disappearing. Wealth is going to the, you know, upper one-tenth of 1%. You know, everybody knows that their wishes in terms of public policy and all that is really not taken into account. So at what point, looking at back historically, are we really poised on the edge of revolution and this is kind of a soft revolution? And the next step, if this cycle doesn't give us real relief from fundamental issues, is going to be even more out there?
Well,
in other words, is this our safety valve? And unless we do something really interestingly different now, it's only going to get a lot worse over the next few years.
Well, here's something to keep in mind. Let's suppose that Sanders triumphs and Trump triumphs, and you now have this seemingly unlike a presidential contest nobody would have predicted a year ago, or certainly 2 years ago. Donald Trump, the arch capitalist, against Bernie Sanders, the lone socialist. Now that would really be something different.
Oh my God!
And people could really, and it would be an interesting contest to see. I don't know how it would turn out.
Well, you have Trump, the capital, you know, $10 billion oligarch, funding his own campaign, except around the edges, you know, a few hundred thousand here and there, and who's counting a few hundred thousand dollars? People are throwing him money because they want to participate, just like they're throwing money at Bernie because they want to participate. And Bernie Sanders, in this huge era of super PACs and the mega-rich and Jeb Bush just wasting $100 million on, what, 4%, 5%? Bernie is doing it literally on shoe leather. Millions of small donations aggregated together again and again, and apparently he's got an unlimited well. This would be a contest, Richard, for the ages, because both positions are so interestingly crafted and opposed.
Yeah, you would appear to have two candidates that are clearly distinguished from each other. So, you know, the old argument that's been made for years is that the Democratic and Republican parties, for all of their rhetoric of difference, tend to behave pretty much the same. And that's one of those things that I think, looking at it as an historian and just looking at someone who takes an interest in politics, that's pretty much true. If you tend to look at many of the policies followed by the Obama administration, they're really fairly consistent with what the Bush administration did, which was actually pretty consistent with what the Clinton administration did.
Except for one big difference.
Yeah.
I mean, Bill Clinton
now,
did not invade another
you've
country.
I
said Bill you've Clinton did a, not invade two other countries, but go ahead.
Yeah. You've got a socialist, and you've got the arch-capitalist. Well, you wouldn't think that there's much that they would have in common. There probably is more than we might suspect.
Actually,
but here's the kind of
Richard
of potential.
We have a problem because Skype, you know, has the delay. So when I say something, you don't hear me, and vice versa. People have made lists now, and they're showing stunningly reciprocal points on both sides, on the Sanders side and on the Trump side. There's a lot more there in common than you might think.
Well, both of them are, you know, certainly present themselves as against the status quo, and that's something that appeals to a lot of people.
But Trump is for a single-payer healthcare system, as is Bernie.
Yeah. Of course, that maybe brings back to a question we'll get to in a minute, is all of this appearance of revolution and difference just another dog and pony show?
Exactly.
You know, the idea, if you want to think, now this isn't say it exists, but if you want to imagine that above the public pageantry of politics, political parties and candidates and elections, you know, one of the things that's been argued, whether it's on the conspiratorial fringe or elsewhere for years, is that, you know, public politics are a kind of dog and pony show. They're a circus. And that the real decisions are made elsewhere, and that one of the reasons why whoever you elect seems in the long run to be pretty much like the last person that you had in the Oval Office is because that's the way it's run. A similar way to put it is the game fixed.
Which takes us, of course, to our big secret society conspiracies, institutions that are behind the scenes, all of those, you know, typical comments and conversations that kind of hover around this. But, yeah, over the years, in my lifetime, Richard, I've seen Republicans come and go and Democrats come and go. I've seen, you know, my grandparents were avid Nixon-Eisenhower fans, as were my parents. And then as the years roll by, you know, you see people come and go, but the policies kind of stay what they call centrist. This is the first election I can remember where the two candidates that are making the most noise, that have the most wind in terms of grassroots response, are really far apart on some very interesting issues, but they're also very similar on some very interesting issues, and they don't fall into these left-right labels at all.
Well, not in terms of what we've sort of been taught to expect is left-right, which, again, is this very narrow divide. You know, it never veers that far to the left, and it never veers that far to the right.
Nope.
You know, whether or not somebody actually thought they were a socialist, the point is, until Bernie Sanders, I don't think, well, probably since Eugene Debs in the 1920s.
Oh, my God, you're going far
I don't,
back.
You'd probably have to go back that far to find really, you know, socialist presidential candidates who could draw any kind of support and simply weren't on the fringe in that way. So the mere term that term sort of is come back in the discourse, that you have someone who identifies them as a socialist and they're running for president and they're drawing support. Again, Trump is very unapologetic about what he is. The one thing I wonder, though, is that if people, let's say that these are the two, you know, just hypothetically, that these are the two nominees and we have an election, whichever one of them wins, there's going to be this huge expectation for change, right?
Mm, absolutely.
Because that's what everybody's voting for.
Everybody on both sides want change, with a capital C.
The danger point, I think, in this is that if these expectations are raised and then they are disappointed, that's when, what will then the alternative be?
Hmm.
At what point, I mean, the question is, at what point do people stop being fed up with candidates and parties, and they end up being fed up with the entire system?
That's what I was asking, yes.
And I don't think we're there yet. I don't know whether we're ever going to get there, but I don't think that it's impossible. I mean, remember, it wasn't that many years ago where we saw something that other people would regard as impossible, and that's the collapse of a superpower, at least the political collapse, and that's the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those things that just wasn't supposed to happen. And after it happened, you had people, and there may have been a few of them, but I think you had a lot of other people jumping on the bandwagon and saying, well, we knew this was going to happen eventually. I don't think most of them did. I don't think there was much serious argument in 1985 or even in 1988 that the Soviet Union was going to go out of business. But it did. We also, in addition to that, have a world with, I think, a proliferating number of what are called failed states. Libya and Syria are examples. Mexico hovers on the edge of that. It hasn't happened, but it could.
Now,
governments essentially lose control.
Are these recent phenomena? Because I don't remember, you know, growing up, you know, paying attention to public affairs, civics, we used to call it way back when. I don't remember the idea of failed states other than a few nations in the middle of Africa that was called Darkest Africa because news was not very easily acquired of what was going on in Africa. Back in the 60s, there were a few small African countries that seemed to kind of hover on that edge, but no one used the term failed state as a kind of a boundary where all kinds of mischief could be created because you simply didn't have a central government.
I think failed state is a new term that's probably undeveloped. It was probably hatched by a political scientist somewhere. I think something like that has happened in the past. Remember, in a previous show, we were talking about the decline and fall of the Ottoman Empire.
Yes.
And the Ottoman Empire was, in its last decades, effectively a failed state. It was bankrupt. It was, you know, it owed everything to foreign creditors. It had foreigners administering its debt. It had internal problems, ethnic divisions that it really couldn't solve except through massacre. I think it meant the equivalent of a failed state, of one that really was barely clinging to it or very close to it. I don't think that's a new phenomenon in history. I think it's just a new term that we apply to it.
Okay.
And it's one of those things that you have to remind yourself every now and then that countries are not immortal. They have a lifespan. They're born, and they'll live for a time, and they'll die like everything else. Societies are the same. Political systems are the same. Political parties are the same. The Republican and Democratic parties have not been the only parties that have ever existed in American history. There's no reason they should continue to be, that they would have to be that. They're bound to change over time, and I think we're on the threshold of a change. I can't tell you exactly what that change is going to be, or
do you think it's as fundamental as, you know, from the Whigs and those kind of archaic terms applied to old political parties? Do you think we're really watching the collapse of, let's say, the Republican Party or the fractionation, and something new will be born from the ashes? I mean, I see, you know, establishment folks desperately now looking to Rubio to stop Trump. And they're also desperately looking to Cruz to stop Trump so that Rubio can stop Cruz. In other words, they're really looking almost like, you know, this election was a bowling alley, and each candidate has a lane. And when some candidate drops out, those voters are not going to go to whoever's remaining. They're going to kind of drop away. So there are people saying that Trump will never get above, you know, 35%, 40%, you know, 70, 60% against him. He can never be nominated, certainly can't be elected. But that seems to be like fighting the last war, because we watched totally amazing things happen over the last 6 months that every pundit did not predict. Every pundit is rushing to catch up to. So how much credence can we give to pundits who now predict that that Trump will be stopped at the convention? We're going to have a good old-fashioned convention fight. Guys get in the back room. Public be damned. They're going to pick somebody, probably Rubio, next generation, and then try to stuff him down the voters' throats. And if that were to happen, I think this term political revolution could just drop the political, because I don't think people would countenance that at all, certainly on the Republican side.
I think it would destroy the Republican Party as it currently exists. And that may be what we're watching in kind of slow motion now, is that party. And I'm not sure what the effect would be, is that Sanders, who's, you know, been aligned with the Democrats but uses a different name for himself, what if this outsider comes in and catches the nomination? And Trump is playing the same role. He's an outsider. He's not part of the Republican establishment. I mean, whatever else anybody may think of him, he's not part of them. They detest him. Everything that they have thrown at him so far has failed. They keep throwing these kind of sacrificial candidates in front of him. They fail. Jeb Bush, which at one point was considered to be the great hope and then shoo-in for the nomination, has failed. You're right, though, about the thing, is that, you know, Trump may be getting 30, 35, 40%, but he's not a majority. And the question will be that he still has, even though in a divided field, seemingly more Republican voters against him, or at least not for him, than he has committed. So if he goes into the convention with, you know, what would appear to be an unassailable position, and in some way through procedural measures he's robbed of the nomination, that would be a pretty desperate move on the part of the establishment, because they're going to have a hard time selling that to people.
Well, of course. And look, that would have worked, in the 30s, 40s, maybe, but not in the era of social media, where even though they want to keep secrets, there are no secrets. We're watching this process in its full glory or non-glory, in real time, and that would be the death knell, I think, for the organized Republican Party if they tried to pull that and they didn't succeed. Even if they did succeed, it wouldn't work because it would be too available to too many people through social media.
And they would be putting up a candidate that would have, by however measure, less appeal than Trump.
Yeah.
If he's the most popular person within the, you know, within the ranks of the party, and they put up a Cruz or a Rubio, they're not really going to compare. And I don't think that people are going to turn out in large numbers to vote for someone that they don't have any confidence in. Conventions are tricky things. And I think one of the things that it's sometimes easy to forget, and we sort of need to remind ourselves, is that, remember, political parties aren't part of the government. Political parties are private organizations. They're private clubs, and they make their own rules. And conventions aren't anything that's constitutional. They're not something which is part of the government. They're something which is run by these private political clubs.
Well,
so
flashing,
they kind of make up what rules that whatever they want.
Flashing back, you know, a couple hundred years, the founders were divided, but most of them, I think, were of the opinion that political parties were really bad news. They did not want the country to devolve into political parties, and here we are. Why didn't they? There were some notable founders who really thought this would be a very bad idea.
Well, they didn't prevent them. Put it that way. Political parties were sort of the norm elsewhere, and you get political interest groups, and you know, again, they're very large clubs. Relatively few people actually belong to them. I mean, Americans register for one party or another, but there's a rather small number of people who actually contribute money to political parties or, you know, are card-carrying members of it in some way. Americans through voter registration for a party, it's kind of this mass baptism. It's like the old idea that you're going to, you know, take the pagan tribe and run them through the river and everybody will be baptized and they'll come out the other side a Christian. I think a lot of political, I mean, there are people, I can tell you that within my family when I grew up, there were diehard Republicans and there were diehard Democrats, and, you know, thank God they were never in the same room together.
Same with our family.
They were on different sides of the family, but that was it, you know. And I don't sense there's quite as much of that partisanship now as there was. I think a lot of people's political loyalties are very soft and are easily sort of changeable in one way or another, which makes these outsider candidates appealing.
Well, and incredibly timely. When we come back, we're at the bottom of the hour, so we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to shift our conversation to the last interesting question, which is, can Trump be stopped? Can Sanders be stopped by the system, by the establishment? And is that going to be kind of similar to what other establishments have done in political situations on a much bigger stage, looking at the world before, let's say, World War II? I'm segueing, as you may have noted, into a discussion of Aleister Crowley, the wickedest man in the world. And what the heck does Aleister Crowley have to do with the current election? Well, you're on the other side of midnight. There will be one. We shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. Yeah, you know, the only thing that can stop Trump now, I think, based on what I'm looking at in the electorate and the deep need for change, is some kind of a conspiracy, some kind of an effort to stop Trump, you know, from within. Which brings up the idea of other political conspiracies. Which brings us to what I wanted to talk about tonight when I had him book you, because we've never really discussed it, and it's so relevant in terms of, NASA, JPL, we'll get into that. Why don't you start at the beginning? You've written a whole book about this guy, and he had a major impact on two world wars. Who the heck was Aleister Crowley, and why should we care?
Well, I suspect that a lot of your listeners have probably already heard at least the name of Aleister Crowley. Because he shows up in all kinds of things. Remember, he's plastered on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's The Beatles album. Usually he's described, this is the kind of quick and dirty explanation, he's the wickedest man in the world, and he was the arch-Satanist and occultist of the 20th century, and that most of the New Age movement and modern Satanism and mysticism are in some way all traceable back to him. Most of that, I'll give you my view of it, and isn't really true.
Hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that he wasn't a professing occultist, but when he's called the arch-Satanist of the 20th century, I'm not sure how many Satanists would actually claim him, and he would never have claimed that title for himself. But I have to give, this is where, to begin with, I have to give a disclaimer. Because Crowley can be a kind of polarizing figure. People either see him as the devil incarnate, or others, you know, there are indeed, there's an entire, it may be a minor, but a real religious movement that views him almost as their kind of Christ figure. So I'm not a follower, okay? So if anybody out there knows what a Thelemite is, or the Church of Thelema, which is sort of the Church of Crowleyanity, I'm not a member of that.
Hey, some of my best friends used to be Thelemists,
yes?
Or Thelemites, or however you pronounce that.
I've known a number of them, and I have to say, and I mean this honestly, every Thelemite or every Crowley I've met has been a very decent person, very nice guy or very nice woman.
Yeah.
Many of them have been quite helpful. I have not run across anything particularly terribly weird or creepy about them. I haven't spent a lot of time with them either. But nevertheless, I can't say that, they never appeared in black cloaks with, you know, a knife sacrificing a goat or that type of thing. That wasn't anything that came along. So I don't approach him from the standpoint of someone who is a believer. I didn't go into him because I wanted to try to prove him to be one thing or another. I was curious, and I wanted to figure out who this guy really was, because his name, you know, he pops up like a jack-in-the-box everywhere.
Yeah, now, you've written a book called what, Secret Agent 666?
Yeah, Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence, and the Occult.
Okay. Now, this gets us from the occult into politics, which is where I want to go this morning. What evidence did you find to support that Crowley, is it Crowley or Crowley?
Crowley.
Okay, because I've always pronounced it Crowley, but anyway.
Holy moly, it's Aleister Crowley.
Okay,
there we go.
All right, all right.
That's the way I was always okay. taught to do it.
So what evidence is there, real evidence, that Crowley was in fact a British intelligence agent bringing all his occult baggage to bear on why he might have been hired?
Well, I'll tell you how I got started with this, and I have a document in front of me, which I'll read to you.
I love documents.
And this is actually a report. I just go back to that Crowley himself claimed at various intervals in his life, usually when he was in trouble for something and he wanted the British government to bail him out, he would claim that during the First World War, which, by the way, he spent in the United States the whole war. So Aleister Crowley arrived in New York on October 31st, 1914.
Okay.
He came to the U.S. on Halloween aboard the Lusitania.
That's kind of interesting.
That's kind of interesting, and you might even think kind of vaguely prophetic. Did he plan it? Well, that's one of those things. The Lusitania made a trip every month across the Atlantic, and it was one of the most common liners. So is there anything more to that than coincidence?
Well, the reason I ask is because there is a very strange and peculiar and semi-secret JPL ritual around Halloween with dummies, mannequins, arrayed in various positions at JPL at the beginnings of in that arroyo where they fired their tiny, small, solid-state rockets back, you know, before World War II. And the Halloween aspect is not lost because Jack Parsons, who was one of the mummies, one of the, you know, mannequins, was a key member of Crowley's establishment. In fact, he took over from Crowley in Southern California when Crowley couldn't, well, I forget the reasons. The point is that, yeah, there is this Halloween aspect, and for Crowley to simply wind up here by accident on that particular weekend, I don't think so.
He might have planned it that way. I mean, the Atlantic crossings at that time, it was... I mean, it's one of the things that interested me. I mean, was this something that you could have picked? And there's a lot that can vary in terms of travel time going back and forth in weather. So the Lusitania might actually have got in a day earlier or a day later or 2 days earlier or 2 days later, so that it would be difficult to absolutely predict with a certainty that you would arrive on Halloween. But then we're talking about Aleister Crowley, so maybe he knew something.
Or he did a ceremony on board to make sure they did arrive on time.
Or, you know, it's the cosmic forces in the universe that arranged this.
Exactly. Yes, yes.
Okay. But there he did. You know, whatever the case may be, he came in to New York on Halloween, and he doesn't go back to England until the end of 1919. So he's in the U.S. through the whole war. And, of course, that would then raise questions later on about, you know, how could an Englishman who had any pretense of patriotic devotions while his country was at war and the empire was fighting, how was it that he spent the whole time off among the Americans? Now, Crowley's argument was that what I was doing in America, I was doing work for His Majesty's government.
So he actually said that?
Yes. Okay. And that, you know, he was doing work there. He never went into any particular details about it. He just said, you know, that there are people that know that I was really doing work, even though, and he admitted this, that, you know, if you really looked at what I did, I was doing things like writing anti-British propaganda for a pro-German magazine. And by the way, he did that. He wrote, and this wasn't, you know, wasn't like he wrote something that somebody thought was anti-British. He was writing deliberate, scurrilous, anti-British propaganda for a magazine published in New York called The Fatherland.
Hmm.
And that was, it was an avowedly pro-German publication, published by a fellow by the name of George Sylvester Viereck. Who was, it was an American, a German-American, but very, very devoted to his old country, and it was Viereck who engaged Crowley to write this. So Crowley had a lot of explaining to do after the war, and this was one of the things that would be raised against him in the press, is this was a man who, when Britain was at war, was a traitor abroad. Now, it's one of those things that you would expect that if someone had spent a war in a other country writing, you know, propaganda in favor of the enemy, that when they came back home, they might get in a little bit of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's one of the interesting things that I found. He gets in no trouble at all, whatsoever.
When you say a little bit of trouble, you don't mean publicly. You mean in terms of officials.
Officials.
In terms of the British government.
He had committed...
Oh, he committed treason.
Prosecutable offenses. Whether or not it was treason, he had clearly given aid and comfort to the enemy during time of war.
Isn't that treason?
It would depend upon, you know, would getting lawyers involved. But you could make it, I mean,
yeah,
in a popular sense.
Yes, in terms of popular opinion, he was a traitor. So why didn't the Brits arrest him then when he goes back home?
They do nothing to him.
Interesting.
In fact, not only didn't they arrest him, they gave him a new passport to go home.
Oh, how thoughtful.
So when the war is over and he's going to go back to England in 1919, he goes to the British consulate, where, by the way, he had various people he knew there. And since the passport he came over with during the war, British passports had changed, so he had to get a new one to go home. If they didn't want him back, they could have just refused to grant him a passport.
Now,
he had
something of an interesting international reputation when he came here.
He didn't have as big a reputation in 1914 as he would have, let's say, by the 1920s, but he had one, and his name had appeared in the American press, usually as a kind of, you know, what they then would call a swami or a mystic of one kind or another.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But so I was kind of curious about this, and the assumption that most people, even people favorable to Crowley, had, was that whenever he, you know, claimed later on in the 20s and 30s that, well, you know, people think I was a traitor during the war, but it looked like I was a traitor, but I was really doing it for a patriotic cause. They thought, well, this is just Crowley making up an excuse.
Does this remind you of some other major figure in 20th century history who was able to kind of go and come between borders? And the border was a lot more solid than the British border after World War One, and yet he was able to kind of flow freely between, across the Iron Curtain. I'm thinking of Oswald and how he was able to defect and then de-defect and just go back and forth, and nobody made any big deal.
Yeah, that was, you know, he sets a reset button. It's like, oh, I decided to defect, and now I don't want to, and I want to go home.
Yeah, okay, this is like Crowley, who does all the seditious stuff and then marches into Piccadilly, and I'm home.
Well, I've said that he's made these claims, which most people dismissed as Crowley just trying to, you know, make some sort of weak attempt at amends for his traitorous activity.
Right.
So one of the things, when I was interested in this, I sent off to see if there was anything that was held in him in the files of what was a kind of American intelligence agency at the time, something called the Military Intelligence Division.
Oh, never heard of it.
So you got to remember that back in 1917 and 1918, there was no CIA and there was no NSA, and there really wasn't an American intelligence agency. So during the war, they drafted the U.S. Army into doing a lot of what we would think it was the work of the FBI. There was the FBI today, and so it's called the MID.
What about the original Secret Service?
Secret Service was there, but the Secret Service was rather narrow in its focus, and that involved protecting the president. It involved dealing and sometimes assisting the Treasury. But the Secret Service wasn't a spy agency, and it wasn't an international. It wasn't an internal police agency. And even the FBI, or as it was called in the Bureau of Investigation, it wasn't the Federal Bureau of Investigation. That was an arm of the Justice Department, but it only had a couple of hundred agents throughout the entire country, and, you know, again, was much a much smaller organization. So the interesting thing about the MID is that
one last question. Wasn't the FBI, though, during World War II really heavily involved in counter-espionage?
Ah, yes, in World War II it was, because J. Edgar Hoover had taken over.
Ah.
Well, we're talking about World War One.
Oh, I see.
Kind of starting out.
Okay.
So Hoover's the guy who turned it into the FBI we all know and love.
I thought that was Robert Stack.
Thing about the MID is that all of its records are declassified. So you can go through its subject files.
Oh.
You can see who they're investigating, and you can read the reports from field agents.
When did this happen? When did they declassify? This is from World War One, right?
Yeah, the MID functioned all the way through the 30s and 40s, and they were probably declassified, I think, let's look at this one, probably in the 70s or the 80s.
Okay.
I mean, not right away, but they're, you know, they're all in the National Archives, and you can go and
After 2000?
I probably started this around 1999.
Okay.
I think that's when I got started. And it was really just one of those things. It was I was just kind of speculating as to whether or not anything would turn up. And sure enough, something did.
Oh.
It wasn't a very big file. And it doesn't say that much, but here was the key point. And usually, you know, one of the things that we historians do, you know, is spend lots and lots of time sorting through huge piles of dusty paper. And about, you know, you can go through hundreds of pages of stuff that is not interesting or is just junk, and then you run into pay dirt. So this is what I found. And this comes from a report from a U.S. intelligence officer by the name of James B. Ord.
O-R-D.
And he was O-R-D. And he was reporting to the headquarters of the United States Military Academy, West Point, New York, because that's where he was stationed. And he's talking about various suspects that he was looking into, and here he has Aleister Crowley, English suspect.
Hmm.
And the key point says, suspect who had been formally investigated by the Department of Justice on charges of being a German spy. It was determined that Aleister Crowley was an employee of the British government, but at present in this country on official business of which the British consul, New York City, has full cognizance.
Ah.
The British government was fully aware of the fact that Crowley was connected with this German propaganda and had received money for writing anti-British articles. Now, what this came from is that, remember, the U.S. had been neutral up until the middle of 1917. But in April 1917, the U.S. joined the war. And then, of course, American authorities became interested in this kind of weird Englishman who was writing anti-British propaganda. And they started looking into him, and they even had an idea one time is that they were going to, well, arrest him. And so they consulted with the British consulate in New York, and it was the British consulate who basically told them to lay off. He's one of ours. That they knew what he was doing, and they were okay with it. Now, the reason that that kind of jumped out at me, because it meant that those things were probably those statements that he made after the war, that, no, I really was doing something for the government. I can't really say anything about it. Well, he wasn't lying. He was. By the admission of the British consul officials themselves, he's one of theirs, and they had full cognizance. And he was there on official business.
But wait a minute, wait.
So of course,
if you're operating in a third country during a major world war as a spy, why would you brag about it? Why would your government even acknowledge it? Why would they...
Well,
I mean, and we're not talking about any spy, we're talking about Aleister Crowley.
It's the British government only acknowledged it to American officials who were on the verge of arresting him.
Okay.
The reports. And so at that point, it was necessary to kind of blow his cover to prevent the Americans from hauling him in or from bringing him in, asking more questions. You know, part of what was going on here, it gets into a bigger question, was that British intelligence had been active in the U.S. since the beginning of the war. And had been, you know, had been carrying out activities in a neutral country, and they didn't really want the Yankees to find out everything they had been doing.
So this opens another question, which is why would the Yankees, our guys, take the Brits' word and not continue a deep investigation to find out what this guy was really doing?
Well, one of the reasons, I suspect, is that one of the people that was involved also in investigating him was the state attorney general, or the assistant attorney general for the state of New York. So remember, you got federal authorities and you have state authorities.
Right.
It was a fellow by the name of Albert Becker. And Albert Becker, in fact, did bring Crowley in and questioned him, or had various meetings with him. And Becker then became sort of very reluctant to really talk about what it, when he would say that Crowley gave me information and he sort of convinced me that he was really sort of, you know, on the side of the Allies and that he was okay. The other thing that probably connected them, though, is that Becker, like Crowley, were Freemasons.
Oh, how interesting.
They're sort of both members of the same, and it goes beyond that. I'm not just talking about, like, your granddaddy's Freemasons, or, you know, or the ones that you may belong to, but of the more mystical bent. And see, that's one of the world was permeated then, and still is, with, you know, what we've talked about before, and the idea of secret societies. And these can be everything from relatively innocuous kind of mainstream secret societies like the Freemasons to more esoteric ones like the Rosicrucians or others whose names nobody has heard of. And the thing is that most people don't belong to those. But a surprising number of people do, and often the higher up you move in society into politics, the more of them you find. And one of the things that those connections, I mean, think of it this way, people belong to the same private clubs. And that gives them a connection. It gives them a certain camaraderie, or it gives them a point of contact or a way to communicate with each other that's lost on everybody else. I mean, that's one of the reasons why people tend to broadly often be suspicious of something like Freemasonry or suspicious of Rosicrucians. The same way you're suspicious of anybody that has a club that they won't let other people in. That obviously, if they're not in the, if they won't let me in it, it's because they're doing something which is, you know, they're up to something.
If and you're if you're an intelligence agency in Britain, did MI5 or 6 exist back then during World War I?
They did, okay. Although I think Crowley's closest association was with the Admiral, with British Naval Intelligence.
Okay. So if Crowley was this very notorious occultist, how could you recruit him as a double agent in a way that would make, A, it believable, and B, sanction whatever he was trying to do, and what would you be getting out of what he was trying to do? I mean, why would the British have employed a wicked guy, a major figure in occult circles, in the first place?
Yeah, a kind of flamboyant weirdo. Why would you bring in a flamboyant... And what you generally want, one of the things that normally you would want from an intelligence operative is that they be inconspicuous.
Exactly.
Okay, you're really not supposed to draw attention to yourself. You're supposed to be as inconspicuous, low-key as possible. But there's also, there's always that sort of rule of opposites, that if on the one hand being inconspicuous can be the norm, on the other hand, I mean, this is the question you get is that, well, and I think you're sort of bringing this up, well, Aleister Crowley was just too flamboyant, he was too out of the mainstream, he was too strange of a character to be a spy. I mean, who would take him seriously? Well, there you got it.
Okay, that's a very interesting
movie. The minute that you would conclude that someone, for whatever reason, couldn't possibly be a spy, you've just created the perfect conditions for them to be one.
I guess we don't think in these days where everybody has no secrets anymore, but there was a time when secrets were guarded, and unless you really told people stuff, most people lived lives of total anonymity, and the only superstars we saw through, you know, film reels or heard on radio or read in newspapers or magazines were people who really, really wanted to be in the full public eye. So, yeah, it became a kind of, I guess, an inverse best defense, because who would possibly suspect that the British fop Crowley was actually doing something serious?
It's sort of like hiding in plain sight. But the advantage it gave him, why would they pick an avowed occultist, a man with a whole variety, you know, with many different secret society connections over the years?
And very controversial positions with those secret societies.
Right, this was someone who was, you know, his outward appearance, it was that he was, if he wasn't a Satanist, he certainly wasn't a Christian. He wasn't mainstream. He was openly contemptuous of mainstream morality. He carried on, and you know, was rather, you know, flagrant in his sexual activities. What used to be called bohemian and then some. But the thing is that the more I tended to look at him, between the kind of the character he played, the person he presented himself being, and then the way that he would present himself to others in more private situations, I came to the conclusion that much of the persona of Aleister Crowley as it was publicly presented was an act. It isn't the real guy. And specifically what I mean by that is that for all of his anti-establishment rebelliousness, of all of his contempt that he showed towards, you know, ordinary morality, the one thing that he would more than once admit in his sort of private moments was that he was, at his core, a patriotic Englishman.
Hmm. So you're saying he basically played to the hilt a role to bury serious work within the role that no one would ever have imagined him, Aleister Crowley, actually carrying out because of the persona.
He's not really the person he pretended to be. Which doesn't mean that he wasn't an awful guy in a lot of ways.
Right.
I mean, and I think one person who knew him, I think it was the writer Dennis Wheatley, said that the one thing he would never do with Aleister Crowley was lend him money or leave him alone with his children.
Mm.
And that would probably be pretty good advice. But he's... one person put it once that Crowley was outwardly this kind of anti-establishment rebel, but one of the things you often find in people who are against something is that there's another part of them which is very much craving to be part of it.
Interesting.
And that the reason why you're rejecting it openly is because privately you really yearn to be a portion of it.
You mean like Elvis Presley wanting credentials from the FBI from President Nixon during his first drug war?
Yeah, or, I don't know, or avowed socialists who express their contempt for capitalism but are never loathed by taking money from capitalists, is another story. And I'm not talking about Bernie Sanders.
I know, a great many
other people.
Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. No, actually, we're at the top of the hour. Time flies, tempest fugits, et cetera, et cetera. My guest this morning is Dr. Richard Spence. We're talking about the most wicked man in the world, who apparently was a spy during World War I and effectively used that position to do a whole bunch of spyish kind of things. After we come back, I'm going to ask a key question now, linking Aleister Crowley, a guy with a reputation, a guy who manufactured his reputation, who lived it large, who could be called huge in some circles even then. Are there any similarities to anybody now in the political landscape? Is there potentially a plan? Are certain people saying things because they believe them? Or because it's a political position designed to get a lot of people to think they believe them? Remember, this time of night we ask questions, hopefully, that others have not. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. It's hovering just below 40 degrees. Gorgeous moon up there, crystal clear stars. It's really been an amazing early, early spring. I'm kind of concerned that various plants and other little creatures will think, wait a minute, it's summer, and it's not going to be summer because something else is going to happen. Okay, moving back to where we were, why would the Brits hire this notorious, very flamboyant, dark, devilish kind of guy? How could he be useful in an intelligence agency?
Because he could get information that other people couldn't.
Like?
And the information he could get was the information that flowed through the occult or other secret organizations which he was aware of or a member of. And again, he's not the only person who was a part of this. I mean, there's this whole world out there of associations that people have. So political figures, people within the German embassy or consulates in America, there are people who were connected together by these invisible associations to everyone else. And I mean, you can think about another sense. I mean, leaving aside the whole idea of the occult, keep in mind that if you look at we live in a society which has sort of, let's say, mainstream sexuality, and that it has not main, it has the outlying area, and there are all kinds of particular cliques and clubs where people do things that are okay within the club and not outside of it. There are the secret, the people live secret lives. Not everyone, but some people. And there is a secret nexus of community of communication between these organizations. Crowley, through his immersion in that world, through his cultivation of occult ideas, through his founding of his own occult organizations, his membership in other ones in secret societies, he had his finger on the pulse of this secret world. Now that's something that not a lot of people could do. And Crowley was willing to do it in the service of his country. And that gave him, I mean, what intelligence is all about is information. The goal of an intelligence agent or asset, and he's an asset in this case. Don't think of him as like a James Bond. Think of him as someone who's being used by an agency as a source of information.
Yes.
But he had sources of information because of his contacts, because of his lifestyle and beliefs that other agents couldn't get. And one of the things that also became pretty apparent was that people in British intelligence who did have to deal with him, in many cases, clearly did so with their fingers gripping their nose. they didn't like him, and it was there was an exchange between a couple of people in British intelligence in the 1920s, and one of the things they were concerned about was the activities of certain secret societies in the Far East. And they were trying to, they wanted someone to give them information on this. And someone, a fellow by the name of, popped up and said, Aleister Crowley would probably be the person to go to for information on this. And I know that, that sort of brings a whole smell into the room when you mention his name.
Mm.
But however reluctant you might be, I would suggest that you approach him because he probably has sources of information that no one else does.
Now, wait a minute. You just said something really intriguing. You said that the British government was concerned with secret societies in the Far East, right?
Yes. I think the actual term they used was some variety of Far Eastern evil.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they thought that there was something going on.
So we're looking at a government interested in a non-governmental institution, kind of transgovernmental, kind of pre terrorism, Al Qaeda, murky institutions that are below the radar, that are occult, that have occult beliefs. Is that what they were looking at?
One of the things that they were interested in, and there may have been others, was this semi mythical Eastern Asian society, which crops up from time to time, called the Green Dragon Society.
Oh. Is this kind of like the counterpart to the White Brotherhood or any other groups like that?
Well, in the Far East, it's a counterpart to a thing called the Black Dragon Society.
Oh, okay.
And so there's that. And the Black Dragon Society is better known because it was a Japanese nationalist society. It was, during the 1920s, well, actually goes back to about the beginning of the 20th century, and it was a secret society within the Japanese establishment, especially within the Japanese military, that was devoted to the kind of mystical ideas of the empire, and of course that meant the expansion of the empire.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that meant was that the Black Dragon Society worked very closely, was kind of joined at the hip with Japanese intelligence.
Hmm.
Now, I had thought when I'd see these little mentions of the Green Dragon Society, that this was just someone getting their wires crossed, and they were really talking about the Black Dragon Society, and they just got the wrong color in it. But then I eventually ran across a statement by, I'm sure many of your listeners will probably remember who Chiang Kai-shek was, okay, the fellow who was the strongman of China before Mao Zedong came along and kicked him out.
Hmm.
And it was a book.
And she was, and he was married to, who was the gal named the Dragon Lady or something?
Oh, Madame Chung.
God, did she come right out of a 1920s, film noir?
Yeah, he had more than one wife, And I think his first wife wrote this memoir about her, you know, my life with Chong, but that wasn't the title of it. But in this, there was just this one little phrase that somebody pointed out to me, and she goes, well, you know, when my husband was trying to gather, you know, a movement for his political movement in China, he got money from the Japanese secret societies, from the Black Dragon and the Green Dragon societies.
And they're both in one sentence.
Yeah, and so they're two different things.
Okay.
So that wasn't it. But that was something that the Green Dragon Society is one of those things. I did a little investigation of it and wrote an article about it a few years back, and it's one of those things that literally hovers on the edge of reality and mythology. I mean, there was a Green Dragon Society, but no one can tell you exactly what its role was. But that's the type of thing that would come up, and that's where you try to figure, I don't know, we have some sort of strange East Asian secret society. I don't know, how many people could tell us about that? There aren't a lot of experts in that. Aleister Crowley supposedly knows all the creepy stuff. Let's ask him.
Interesting.
And that's a little example of the way that he could be useful to them in ways that other agents couldn't, that more mainstream agents couldn't be. And it also brings up the fact that British intelligence, as any agency, doesn't employ agents because they like them or because they trust them, but because they can be useful.
Yes.
That's why they would bring him in. So I think most people in the British establishment who knew anything about him viewed him with distaste. I think some of them who publicly viewed him with distaste were more amenable to him in private. And there might have been people who pretended to be friendly with him in private who detested him otherwise. It's one of those things that you can't, that the public persona that people present isn't, and in fact seldom is, the real person. And I think one of the problems with Crowley is that Crowley liked cultivating this image of being wicked. And he was actually a British publicist. I think it was a newspaper, a fellow who ran a newspaper, a kind of ultra-patriotic newspaper, a fellow by the name of Horatio Bottomley. And I think he's the fellow that branded Crowley the wickedest man in the world.
Hmm.
But and in a way, Crowley kind of liked that.
Of course he did.
In the same way that, you know, the other thing that he's been called is the Great Beast 666, mm-hmm. a name which he embraced for himself. You know who was the first person who called him the Great Beast?
No.
His mother.
You're kidding.
No, his mother. This, by the way, I guess is something to bring out to some people. Aleister Crowley, you know, the infamous occultist, grew up in a Christian fundamentalist household. He was raised a strict Christian fundamentalist in the Plymouth Brethren. His father was a lay preacher.
So obviously you could say, if you're using pop psychology, that what Crowley, was basically mandated by reaction and rebellion against his upbringing.
Kind of. I mean, yes, he rebelled against this strict Christian fundamentalist upbringing, but another way of thinking about it is that Crowley had some kind of love-hate relationship with his mother. You know, she called him the Beast, and he kind of liked that. But he was very attached to his father, but his father died when he was, I think, 11 or 12. Hmm. And so he kind of idolized his father, even though his father was again, a man who had a certain amount of money, but, you know, the Crowley's family money, by the way, came from a brewery. But his father took that money and money that he gained through investing in real estate and used it to finance his preaching. He saw himself on a religious mission. Crowley, in his own way, even though he rejected his father's fundamentalist Christianity, keep in mind he continued, in a way, his father's idea of being a spiritual leader and preacher.
Hmm.
Because the difference is that Crowley's father preached Christianity. Aleister Crowley, the son, invented his own religion and preached it.
He went to the dark side of the force.
He kind of went to the dark side of the force, and he found that he found that as a way to, you know, and he embraced that. He sort of embraced the bad boy image, and therefore when someone would call him the wickedest man in the world, he would, you know, take it in. But what happened is that as time went on, this role, this wicked persona that he embraced, this kind of character that he played, and I think it was literally a character that played, but you know the old saying, if you play the role long enough,
yep,
the role starts to play you.
Yep, and they warn losing yourself in the role.
Then that's what happened to him, and when he wanted to try to redeem himself, he tried about this whole campaign in the early 30s in the British press to try to get good press that would reverse the bad press he had, to sort of regain, because one of the things he'd realized is that this had, you know, he sort of accepted this wickedest man in the world image, but he'd completely tainted everything else about him. And that now no one, other than those few people who knew him intimately, could see him as anything else but that. He had become typecast in the role of the Beast 666, and he found that he could not be taken seriously and or accepted in any other role, and he tried to change that unsuccessfully. He was never able to escape from this kind of trap that he'd built for himself.
Hmm. If we go to the homepage of othersideofmidnight.com tonight, if we go to the upper right-hand corner and click on Radio with Pictures, that takes you to Richard's page tonight. We have several links. Why don't we kind of go through what these are, because they look intriguing, and I recognize the third one immediately, but we'll say that for a second.
Okay, I don't have them in front of me right now.
Okay, can you easily get there?
I think I can easily get there.
Yes. Everyone should always, when they do this show, folks should sync their computers, because you never know when I'm going to go over to Radio with Pictures. I mean, just the physical appearance of Crowley is kind of off-putting. This is a picture I think we have in link number two when he was kind of in later midlife. But he did not look kind of guy that you'd invite to a dinner party, a high upper-class dinner party.
The classical picture you have of him, I think, is one up there, is the one where he's staring straight ahead and he's got the bullet bald head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he shaved his head bald for the same reason that a lot of men do, because he was losing his hair.
Okay.
You know, and the way that, you know, eventually you can kind of, you know, deal with that is just to, you know, damn the whole thing and shave it off. For a while, he actually kept a forelock of hair on the front of his forehead, and you'll see some pictures with that. And
We also have a link to your book up on Amazon at the bottom of your bio.
Yes, and I think the same picture appears
there.
The
same picture,
Yeah, that's the favorite one that you tend to see. And why don't you tell me the picture you're talking about, because I'm not working with a computer that's mine.
Okay, it's just basically the same. You know, he's kind of wearing a robe. He's looking out at the camera.
Oh, he's in his Masonic regalia.
Yes, yes.
Okay. In fact, that's a picture taken in the States in 1916,
title of the piece is "The Man Who Chose Evil."
Right. And I think there's also one there that's a newspaper from an American newspaper in that period.
Yeah, I think that's the one we're talking about. Yeah, it looks like a newspaper.
Here we go.
It's not. I can't double click it and make it bigger for some reason. So, but yeah, it seems to be a newspaper. So he basically made his career out of doing the most outrageous things. And you say maybe privately he was playing a role that he wasn't really this bad guy. Well, that brings up another public figure who has made all kinds of outrageous statements, Richard, in the major question that people are now asking, is this guy going to continue, or is he going to modify his behavior to ingratiate himself with more middle-of-the-road voters, and you know who I'm talking about, Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Donald Trump has been as outrageous, that's why the comparison this morning, in the political realm, as Aleister Crowley was in the intelligence realm.
Well, one of the things that that Crowley would do. He did it in the U.S. during World War I. He did it earlier in Mexico, and I think he did it later. I think one way to describe what he would do is that he would often show up in places. He would take an openly anti-British or in some way stance that would attract attention. It would attract people to him. And then he waited to see who showed up.
Hmm.
I mean, part of this was a way of trying to, you know, get people out of the woodwork.
In other words, he was fishing. He was setting the bait and he was fishing.
He's fishing. He was setting out a bait. You know, he's setting out this line, and he was seeing who took the bait. Because this is one of the ways, for instance, that you could do things like flush out people who held pro-German sympathies. So remember, if you show up someplace and go, I am a dissident Englishman, or even as he did at one point, claimed to be an Irish nationalist, and he wasn't in any sense. He never convinced any Irish of that. He did convince gullible Germans that he was.
Okay.
So they had a hard time apparently telling the difference between Englishman and Irishman as as it was. But he would do this thing of just sort of setting himself up and putting out this line, making, you know, inflammatory statements, and then seeing who sort of appeared and finding out what their views would be. You know, this idea, again, of finding out this, the kind of secret or the disguised or hidden affinities or beliefs of people. And one of the ways is that you have to pretend like that you're one of them. So if you go back, I guess, to the question of Donald Trump, I guess, is Donald Trump the same thing as he? Is it an act?
I've got to say, the more I looked at this, and I've looked at this now, and this audience knows because I talk about it freely. I mean, when you get your own radio show, you can talk about stuff, right? So I talk about things that are intriguing. I find the Trump phenomenon, normal politics notwithstanding, astonishingly intriguing because I just get this feeling that it's all a huge put-on. And it's designed to maneuver us somewhere, and he really is something totally different than what we think. There are forces behind him because we've arrived now at this kind of, you know, linchpin in the middle of the road where history can go this way or that way. It's kind of like we're at a fork now, and we can decide which path we're going to take. The arrival of Trump and the Trump phenomenology and the rewriting of all the rules and appealing directly to, in some cases, the worst of human behavior, I just get this feeling it's a script and it's not that he really himself, from the intel I have from other people, this is not the Donald Trump that they have ever heard from in years past.
A very different guy in private than the one who appears in public.
Yep.
Well, there's an element certainly in Trump, and again, I'm not trying to take, you know, sides in it. I'll try to look at it objectively. That I think that he knows how to play a role, and let's put it this way: he's had practice playing a role, right?
Yeah,
he's been on TV. He's, you know, he's got his old catchphrase. So here you've got someone who sort of presents himself publicly in one way, gruff, outspoken, not afraid to offend people, not afraid to be tough if he's going to. You know, people expect Trump to behave in a certain way.
Let me do a little ellipsis here in the middle of this conversation. One of the things that got me thinking that we're not seeing what's really going on, that there are five levels deeper that we're totally unaware of yet, when was the last time you saw the Pope take out after one individual and, without naming him, framing his policies and attack him as being un-Christian?
Un-Christian.
Un-Christian. Yeah. In other words, what was the Pope calling Donald Trump? He was calling him the Antichrist.
Yeah.
It's at that level, and nobody got it, Richard. That's what's so astonishing. We're looking at this incredible maelstrom, this sea with 100-foot-high seas politically that have never happened in our lifetime, and people are pretending that it's common for the Pope to attack a guy running for president and for the guy running for president to attack back and then increase in the polls. To me, this is the most remarkable CAT scan of the consciousness of us, the consciousness of the Pope and the Vatican and what they're seeing and their efforts to try to play a role at this very early stage. And it did not go well for the side of the Vatican, did it?
I don't think it didn't budget one inch.
No. So
I don't know whether that tells us about the limited power of the papacy or the staying power of Donald Trump. But see, the thing is that Trump, you know, whether you love him or hate him, what you have to admit is that he's doing something that gets attention and which clearly catches. I'm not even sure in some cases people are paying that much close attention to what he says as how he says it.
Hmm.
And I think that the fact that he's defying the convention, you know, he seems to be. I mean, look, he's you know, one of the 1% himself, but he's posing himself. I mean, he's positioned himself as the insider outsider. You know, someone who is not part of the establishment, and yet in another way is. He's simply not part of the traditional Republican establishment, and I think a lot of those people are clearly flummoxed and infuriated about him. But they don't seem to know how to deal with this, because he's not speaking their language, because there's always this unstated rule, remember, of what are the acceptable bounds of political discourse. You ever heard that?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. You know, there's certain things, you know, it, which is really just a version of the old idea that there are certain things you never discuss in polite society.
Well, you don't call the other candidate a liar, and it has been done now to death. You know, in the last week, more candidates have called other candidates liars, not, you know, the gentleman is twisting facts, or the gentleman is in error in his recollections, or the gentleman exceeds his, you know, no, they're just calling each other liars. The biggest liar. And people, it's like we've moved this discourse 5 light years in 6 months, and we're now thinking this is normal.
It's as rough and tumble and as, you know, or as impolite as it may be, there's a certain, you know, I've been in situations where, you know, you're looking at what someone's done or said, and people are using terms, well, they misrepresented this or they did that. And everybody sitting around the table knows that what's happened here is that someone
lied and somebody got caught at it.
But that's something that rarely you directly want to confront them with, because once you've said that you're lying, there's really no sort of coming back from that. I mean, that's...
Well, there's no negotiating room. There's no... Yeah. What was a Sun Tzu who said, always leave your enemy an escape route?
Yeah.
Once you've done that, you have closed off escape routes, and that's what Trump is doing. But see, I want to go back to the idea, is Trump playing a role like Crowley was playing a role? And so let's follow Crowley's role up to and into World War II, because that's when things get really intriguing.
Well, he goes through, I think he served, I mean, his approach with British intelligence is that he served them at their discretion off and on over the years as he could be useful. And on the other hand, when they didn't need him, they were perfectly willing to keep at arm's length and sort of bring him back. But one of the things you found is that despite his bad reputation, one of the things about the guy is that he never suffers any serious consequences legally from what he does. It's as if he had, and this was only sort of, I realized this when I had sort of looked, sort of sat back and looked at the problems he had, but he always managed to get it. It's like he had a secret get out of jail or, you know, don't go to jail card with him.
Hmm.
You know, so he writes German propaganda during the war. He gets a new passport, comes back to Britain. Nobody touches a hair on his head. He didn't have any hairs, but if he did, they wouldn't have touched them. He becomes in the 1930s a bankrupt. And he's a bankrupt for the rest of his life until he dies in 1947. He is an undischarged bankrupt. Yet, he's never without a roof over his head. He's never without clothes and food, lives pretty well. In fact, another thing that he had become over the years, by that time, was a hopeless heroin addict.
Hmm.
By the way, not quite for the reasons you might assume, he was an enthusiastic consumer of recreational drugs, things like mescaline and ether. But heroin wasn't one of them. He got addicted to heroin because he took it as a treatment for asthma.
Hmm. That's
intriguing. It was one of those things that was prescribed. He suffered from asthma from the time he was a boy. But one of the things is that he became a junkie. He kicked it. He went back on it. I think eventually in the 30s he sort of gave up. And one of the things he got is that he registered with the authorities as a, I think, a hopeless addict. And so he got his little package of heroin every week from a pharmacist.
So they basically set him up for life, for doing something. Something in service to his country. We're at the bottom of the hour. So we're going to take a pause. My guest this morning is Dr. Richard Spence. We're discussing Aleister Crowley, the most evil man in the world, who, in some part, apparently took that on as a role to achieve other objectives. Is that an analog of things we're currently looking at? Stay tuned and we'll find out. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
Rise up into the clouds. Wish you could see. Just held out. Oh, that some things are just better not said.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Dr. Richard Spence. We're talking about Aleister Crowley. Okay, so you basically, to your own satisfaction, have proven in this book, Secret Agent 666, that Crowley was in fact an agent, an asset of British intelligence during World War I. How did he make a difference? Did he do anything that we should be looking on Crowley now in a different light? Did he make some major contribution that up until now we don't know about?
Well, here's what he thought he did. Here's what he sort of patted himself on the back on in his own private diary, where he's writing to himself. He believed that his efforts in the U.S. prior to 1917 had been instrumental in bringing the United States into the war. Now, that's one of those things that, in a broader sense, was a very important secret. You can think of it this way, a cult goal of British intelligence and certain British politicians from the beginning of the war. The idea of bringing the U.S. into the war on the Allied war effort, that was something that was greatly desired, especially in London. And therefore, Crowley, in his way, he wasn't the only agent that was operating to that end, but he believed that he was able to do that. Now, why did he think that? Well, one of the reasons he thought that is that by... See, one of the things, one of the ways he explained his writing anti-British propaganda for a pro-German magazine was he said, look, if you actually read the stuff that I wrote and you understand how I was writing it, you realize that it's all over the top. It was, in fact, something that the Germans didn't catch on, that I was lampooning their propaganda. And the interesting thing is that if you look at it that way and go back and look at the things that he writes, I don't think I'm imagining it to say that you can then see exactly what it is that he's talking about. So one of the things, for instance, he wanted to convince the Germans of was that he goes, look, you know, the Americans are this neutral country and you're upset that American businesses and factories are supplying weapons to your enemies. And there are different ways that you could approach them, but he gave them this advice. You have to understand that the Americans are like children. They're an unsophisticated people. And like children, they respond to a firm hand. So rather than trying to reason with the Americans, instead, what German propaganda should do and what Germany should do is present itself as forceful and powerful. And this will overawe and frighten the Yankees. And that is how we will do it. So, you know, rather than try to convince or court the Americans, instead you should simply try to show them how fearful and powerful Germany was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to convince people that that was the proper approach.
Which, of course, had exactly the opposite effect.
has exactly the opposite effect. It did not work at all. And indeed, if you look at, I mean, I wouldn't argue, for instance, that German propaganda probably wouldn't have failed without his help, but he was helping in that way. He was encouraging traits within German propaganda that were already counterproductive to its purpose. And that was, you know, his way. Yeah, would the U.S. have entered the war without Aleister Crowley? Almost certainly. But in his way, did he play his role in it? Did he play his part? I think he did. And his role may not have been inconsequential. It's one of those things that, I mean, his chief advantage is that he was able to infiltrate what the Germans called the propaganda cabinet, which was this sort of secret organization that they had in New York and Washington that was supposed to coordinate German activities and inside the neutral U.S. propaganda-wise, and he could report on everything. I mean, the British even managed to tap a telephone line that went into these private meetings. And as far as I can tell, it could only have been Crowley, who's the only outsider who was invited to these, who could have told them what line to tap.
Oh, interesting.
So he could be useful in that regard, and the British would bring him back into the fold. During the 20s, he was kind of, you know, he was sort of out in the cold. Here's another example of how people in British officialdom would come to his rescue. So during the 20s, he doesn't spend much time in Britain. It always creates problems because if he comes back there, then immediately part of the press, who again views him as the wickedest man in the world, will start, you know, inveighing against him, and that attracts attention. And the reason why he would stay away is that nobody wanted too much. Nobody wanted to go any real question about what he was actually doing during the war. And that's why even Crowley himself would never give a lot of details on it. And some people would argue that, well, he would claim that he was working with naval intelligence or he was working in the government, but he never gives us any details because there aren't any. Well, he couldn't give any details because he couldn't give details. Because he understood one thing very well. There was a thing called the Defense of the Realm Act, DORA. Mm-hmm. And the Defense of the Realm Act was brought in the war and is still around. It morphed, you know, the Official Secrets Act. And that's serious business. And the Official Secrets Act basically says that you keep your mouth shut. And that also is a general rule for people who've worked with any intelligence agencies. You know, you may talk, you may say that you work for the agency, you might say that you were posted here, but you never, ever, as long as you live, without express permission, ever talk about anything operational. You don't talk about it, or you become a persona non grata very quickly. And therefore, one of the things that he knew is that he could never, you know, why didn't he simply describe what it was he did? Because if he did, then the protection he had, that sort of invisible helping hand who, when he needed it, would sort of emerge out of British officialdom and get him out of trouble, that would be gone.
That almost says, almost by circumstantial evidence, that he must have made, in someone other's eyes than his own, some contribution to be kind of be maintained for decades after his period of service?
Well, he would come back into service in different ways. So,
well, before we get there, let me add, because Torch has been very patient, and I'm sure has an exquisite question. Good morning, Torch. Welcome to the other side of midnight.
Good morning, Richard. And Richard and Em, how are you?
We're fine.
You don't know how closely this show is related to last night's show. And everything is intertwined. I mean, you glossed over photo number one. I mean, if you go back to it on the Radio with Pictures.
Okay.
Oh, the eye in the pyramid.
Yes.
Yes. Which is the emblem of the British counterintelligence force, MI5.
Isn't that special?
I mean, if you look at it. Go ahead.
I mean, of all the emblems you could come up with, why the eye in the pyramid?
Yeah. Okay, Torch, go on. You're on a roll.
The whole thing is a pyramid, too.
Yeah, of course. It's an equilateral triangle. It's actually a tetrahedral pyramid.
Right. Well, Crowley got the title as the most evil man in the world because he was basically the most evil man in the world at the time. He devoted himself to Satan. He sold his soul to the devil, and he even admitted to sacrificing over 200 children at his estate in Loch Ness. I don't know if you know that, but...
Wait a minute. He admitted to sacrificing 200 kids, and he didn't wind up in prison?
Yes.
How? I mean, this kind of goes back to what Richard is saying, that he had protection.
Exactly. And who do you think his protection is?
Richard?
Did he sacrifice? Did he sacrifice 200 children, or did he have protection against that? Well, leaving aside the sacrifice question, another reason why he would be assisted beyond his continual usefulness is that there were people inside the intelligence agencies who were simpatico to his occult beliefs.
Who basically felt they could use magic in a systematic way to advance the nation.
Correct.
They could. They could do it that way, or they were members of the same organizations that he was a member of.
Okay.
And it all goes back to the one essential person that I explained to you last night about, the Dark Lord. Satan himself is the ruler of this world. And his pledge, his oath, was to undo God's creation. And that who is running things all along through the background and is still. And that's, he uses the media, he uses the music industry, he uses everyone that will give himself over to him. And
okay.
That's what's going on.
Well, that's an important thing to note. You know, I'm going to move on now because we have a lot of other callers, but That's an important backdrop to give the context for why the most wicked man in the world would get protection from the British government for doing, we don't quite know what. Anyway, thanks, Torch.
Take care.
Morning, Ryan. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
And we're getting some kind of weird noise from somewhere.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, but we're getting a hum. Okay, now the hum is gone. Go ahead.
I think that there are other people, pop stars, not only at the time that this happened, but currently. And I don't think it's Donald Trump, but I think there's probably a high likelihood, if this method worked for the British, that other countries use pop stars and weird iconic figures in the public to do the same thing.
Richard?
Any thoughts?
Richard?
Yeah. I mean, is he unique? Well, go back to one of the most infamous portrayals of Crowley, the same picture, the same bald-headed picture, remember, was placed by the Beatles on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's. Now, true, he's only one of a number of people there, but these are all people that they picked for some reason. But he appears there, and of all, you know, of the faces that would appear, he is there for a specific reason. And arguably, you know, one of the things that happened is that in the 60s, Crowley had a kind of renaissance. He died in 1947, but in the 60s, some people would argue that Crowley's vision of the future, his Age of Horus, the idea of, you know, of free love, of throwing off sexual conventions, of the rise of alternative spirituality, that was really his kind of prophecy come true. And there was a renewed interest in him in that period.
Would it
he
be fair
a kind of icon?
Would yeah. it be fair to say that Crowley was kind of behind the whole occult in modern music, in film, the whole idea of, you know, The Exorcist, all that. Did that really basically stem from Crowley's 60s reemergence as a kind of a mini superstar in this realm?
Well, I got to remember, when he emerges as a cultural icon in the 60s, he's long dead.
Right.
And while I think you would get different interpretations. Mine would come down firmly in the idea that if Aleister Crowley was alive during the 60s, or somehow you managed to resurrect him and bring him back, he would have hated the entire thing.
And the reason?
Because he was, as he put it once, you know, what he really wanted to be was inside, he was a conservative English gentleman. And he was. And maybe he sold his soul to the devil, and he certainly embraced, he played with and embraced and used this idea of evil.
Okay, one more question.
Yes, Ryan, go ahead. Ryan?
Go ahead.
What about other people that he was around, such as Parsons? There's other key figures. There's a guy named Nick Redfern who wrote a book called The Collins Elite.
Yeah, Richard, why don't you get into Parsons? Because he's an incredible bridge to our work.
Well, Jack Parsons, John Whiteside Parsons, I think he was originally born with the name Marvel.
Now that's weird.
Yeah. He again came from a wealthy family in Southern California, was fascinated with rocketry, was, you know, a founding figure, you know, in terms of sort of a pioneer in the American space program. I think his big contribution was coming up with a solid fuel rocket.
Yes, he developed a solid fuel, and they did a lot of tests there in the Arroyos.
There are still people who argue that JPL stands for Jack Parsons Lab.
I know.
That apparently was that was a joke I heard before I even knew it was a joke or what it meant. But Parsons was one of those people, as there were, who were fascinated with Crowley's idea, his spirituality, his idea of this new... I mean, what Crowley sort of predicted was what he hoped for, what had never really materialized, at least in a dramatic way, was that he was going to unleash a new spiritual movement on the world as great and sweeping as Christianity, and that this would sweep away Christianity, which he believed as it existed was a kind of dead religion, and it was going to bring in this new faith, the Aeon of Horus.
This is Crowley's vision.
This is Crowley's idea.
Okay.
That he was going to be a prophet in the mold of Jesus or Muhammad or Buddha, and that this whole new spiritual awakening would appear. And, you know, nothing, I think, through most of his life, his success in that was very, very limited.
Parsons now, or are we talking Crowley?
But Parsons was one of those people who became attracted to these ideas. And keep in mind, Parsons is an American.
He's a young rocket engineer in Southern California.
He's a completely different generation.
He's at Caltech.
Never meets Crowley. He corresponds with him, but the two do not physically meet. Parsons knew people who were connected with Crowley, and he got his approval to restart something that was called the Agape Lodge. Crowley basically took over. He didn't found, but he took over an existing occult order that was founded in Germany called the Ordo Templi Orientis, the OTO. And there's a whole story as to how he essentially got a hold of it, but he did. Not to the satisfaction of everybody. And Parsons became fascinated with these ideas and with the whole idea of occultism and magic, and he founded or refounded or helped to restart a lodge of the OTO in Pasadena, which attracted people from out Southern California. Of course, there were lots of cults going on in L.A. at the time.
Including an individual named L. Ron Hubbard.
L. Ron Hubbard. Who, by the way, met Parsons after he'd gotten out of the Navy during World War II. And you know what Parsons did in the Navy?
Don't remember.
He was an intelligence officer.
Oh, that's right.
Okay. So you got L. Ron Hubbard who shows up, and I guess the most infamous story is that he and Jack Parsons basically take, I think, then Jack Parsons' girlfriend out to the Mojave Desert, where they perform one of Crowley's rituals, which was meant to incarnate the spirit or the goddess of Babylon into a moon child. So what they did was they went out in the desert and they had ritual sex with Parsons' girlfriend in order to incarnate a spiritual being that she would give birth to.
Mm-hmm.
The upshot of that is that I don't think they succeeded with the spiritual being, but what happened was that L. Ron Hubbard ran off with a girl and a lot of Parsons' money.
And a yacht, I believe.
Yes, and used it to buy yachts, and then found that his own... Then, oddly enough, if you think about it, kind of mimics Crowley, doesn't he?
Yes, of course.
I mean, what Hubbard does is just to kind of take that idea that I'm going to create my own spiritual dispensation by coming up with this new idea, and just sort of takes Crowleyanity and, you know, morphs it and twists it and turns it into Scientology.
Okay, so we now have a NASA guy, very influential in creating JPL, creating a whole field of rocketry, basically led to the first successful U.S. satellite launched by JPL, et cetera, who was an accolade of the most evil man in the world. And then I find when I come along and I start looking at NASA and I start seeing all these occult symbols and occult dates for doing things and arriving and landing and launching. And in other words, all of NASA beneath this surficial, glittering, scientific, you know, 27th century appearance, actually, when you get beneath the surface, there's an awful lot of Crowleyism, particularly at JPL through Parsons, which even today JPL is quietly practicing.
Well, see, that's one of those things we were talking before, that Aleister Crowley could see that you and I or others can't see, that maybe we get glimpses of, we kind of think there's something there, but we can't see it. But he had the knowledge or the experience to make the invisible world visible. And therefore, when he looked at organizations, when he looked at people, whether it was inside British intelligence, whether it was inside JPL, whether it was inside Eton or whether Cambridge, he was aware of these secret connections. He was aware literally of the occult in the sense of the occult being something which is hidden, not spooky, but hidden. Mm-hmm. And he was aware of the hidden connections that permeated society. And that, I mean, the whole British upper crust, the whole Edwardian world, he's born in the 1870s, and he lives during the late Victorian and Edwardian periods. And the whole thing in British society is just one big collection of secret clubs and cliques.
Hmm.
It was who you knew, and it was the kind of introduction you got. And he knew that because he got into Cambridge through the political influence of his aunt.
Okay.
She knew important people in the British Conservative Party. In fact, there was a kind of little club, a little secret society they had called the Primrose League.
Uh-huh.
And it was through the influence of people she knew there that she was able to get her nephew into the right school. Because let's face it, not everybody got into Cambridge. And you got in there because you had connections, and he got those connections through her. And he learned, and that was maybe an early lesson in how the secret world works.
You know, in the back of my mind, there's been this other question, which is, what's the connection between Ian Fleming, British intelligence, James Bond, all that, and Aleister Crowley?
Ian Fleming also worked for British intelligence during World War II. In fact, he was the secretary to the head of British intelligence. And there's a connection, you know, Crowley was fairly old by the time the Second World War came along, but he did his bit. In this case, he didn't write pro-German propaganda to make it look bad. He wrote he wrote a kind of poem for victory. He wanted to he was very patriotic. He wanted to participate in the war effort. The thing, though, that I found most interesting is that right when the war broke out, he gets a note from the then head of British Naval Intelligence basically asking him to come by for a visit.
Oh. Oh, my.
And he's given a phone number to call, to contact a particular officer to arrange it. And I had a friend of mine in the UK, who does things like, you know, goes through historical phone numbers.
Hmm.
And he was able to determine that the telephone exchange in London that Crowley was told to call was the exchange to a branch of British naval intelligence which dealt with prisoner interrogations.
Oh, my God. They weren't asking him to talk to the guy I'm thinking of, were they?
Well, now this comes into something which is a story as opposed to a fact, but it's a fairly persistent one. And one of it has to deal with the close associate of Hitler, Rudolf Hess.
Yep, that's the guy.
And Hess was captured by the British and held during
the
war.
He flew to Britain, to what, Scotland, to give himself up to act as some kind of a negotiator because of some huge astrological occult meanings he read into the war at that point, right?
Supposedly he was a devotee of, I mean, Hess himself was steeped in an occultism of all forms. And the simple explanation is that he had found astrological alignments that led him to believe that this was an advantageous time to negotiate peace. What he was really doing, and this is another story in itself, is that there was, in fact, it wasn't a myth, a large party in Britain at that time who were willing to negotiate a peace. And that's the people he came to contact.
Oh, how interesting. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. 2 hours have flown by. I tell you what, let's pick up Crowley next time, and talk about World War II and the thing that I think is so interesting that the Brits got him involved in being an occult spy in World War I. It was the occult that got us into, I'm obviously collapsing a lot of history here, into World War II, maintained the Hitler, Goebbels, you know, ensemble of all these interesting occult developments and incidents that we now know of in hindsight. How did Crowley play into that? Well, we're going to have to leave it there because, unfortunately, we don't have time this morning to finish that question. Richard Spence, thank you so much for being my guest this morning. Historian Richard Spence, University of Idaho. Well, tomorrow morning is Open Hailing Frequencies. We're going to have a couple of surprises. Yes, real surprises. So until tomorrow morning, same time, same bat channel, keep remembering, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.